Good evening.
We have a quorum, so we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order at 6:03. So, welcome to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. My name is John Cabot, and I'm the chair for the Northern RAC, and I represent non-consumptive from Hooper. I think we'll go ahead and begin by introducing all the RAC members, and so Craig, why don't we start over here, Wade?
I'm Craig Van Tassel from Camas, and I'm a sportsman representative.
John Blazard from Camas, I represent agriculture.
Kevin McLeod, West Haven, at large.
Mike Lauder, sportsman's rep, Hooper.
Matt Clark, Ogden, at large.
Justin Oliver, West Haven, at large.
Paul Chase, out of Logan, Forest Service.
John Wall from Riverdale, public at large.
Kristen Purdy from Ogden, non-consumptive.
Bryce Thurgood Perry, at large.
And Justin Doling, I'm the regional supervisor, and I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
Okie doke, thank you. I'd like to recognize Byron Bateman, who's here. He's our wildlife board member. And please join me, if you will, in turning off your cell phones so that we can have an uninterrupted meeting tonight. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management, policy rules, and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board then considers those recommendations from the five regional councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. Okay, the meeting for tonight will be recorded, so when presenting information or asking questions, we do ask that you use the microphone and speak into that, and also if you wouldn't mind providing your name so that we can have a good record of tonight's meeting. I believe the minutes were circulated for everyone, so let's go ahead and take a look. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the agenda. If there is no objection, then we'll go ahead and approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. Seeing no objection, the agenda for tonight is approved. Everyone should have also received minutes from the previous meeting. I believe that was back in December. I can't recall. But if there are no edits or changes to the minutes, we'll approve the minutes as circulated. Seeing none, the minutes from the previous meeting are approved. Okay, the next business in order is the Wildlife Board update. We had the Wildlife Board meeting on December 9th, and if you recall, there were a couple of items on the agenda that passed through our RAC. The first was the elk management plan. That elk management plan was approved as presented by the division. We had also the bucks and bulls and once-in-a-lifetime season dates. Those were also approved as presented. There was an amendment made to that motion that the motion be amended to include an archery-only mountain goat hunt on the north slope, south slope of the High Uintas, and an archery-only bison hunt on the Henry Mountain Unit. The motion was then amended again a second time, and that they excluded the once-in-a-lifetime seven-day archery only that was proposed. And so those items were passed. There was also a motion for the preference point system that was presented to us, and that was accepted as presented. Then we also had the Northeastern Regional Deer Management Plan, and those were presented as presented by the division. The CWMU management plans and permit numbers for 2017. The motion that was accepted was that the division's proposal include that the operator of the Deer Creek CWMU report to the advisory committee in a year to review all those improvements, and then they'll be taken back up by the Wildlife Board. And then the Landowner Association permit numbers for 2017 were also passed as presented by the division. So that was the summary for the Wildlife Board meeting. We have now on the agenda the regional update.
Actually, Bryce has got to give the January 3rd
board update. Oh, and we had a January 3rd meeting. Bryce?
Okay. On the January 3rd Wildlife Board meeting, that one was on the waterfowl and the black bear. The first one on the waterfowl recommendations, it passed unanimously 5-0 as presented. The next one on the black bear, there was a few changes on the black bear. And first of all, there was a motion to move two permits from the spring to summer on the Bonanza Diamond unit. That passed 5-0. The next, there was a recommendation the Bear Committee look at the book cliff seasons on the next round, and they also look at the bonus point preference points for the pursuit season. Then there was a motion that the bear permits numbers be rounded down and not up on the drawing permits to 10%. That passed 4-1. And then the balance of the presentation passed 5-0. As presented. Other than that, there was the AIS rule amendment the private pond rule amendment. There wasn't much discussion. That passed 5-0. The AIS rule amendment for aquatic invasive species, that passed 5-0. And the dedicated hunter rule amendment also passed 5-0. So I think that's all.
All right. Thank you, Bryce. All right. The next business in order now is the regional update.
Well, good evening, everyone. Just let me give you a brief update on what's going on with the region. I know it's been a while since we've met, so there's been a lot of stuff going on. Our law enforcement section's been staying pretty busy with this shed antler gathering closure. That closure is through... Well, actually, the opening of that closure will be April the 1st, and so they've been fairly busy, mostly responding to other people that are turning folks in for going out and illegally collecting sheds. The law enforcement group is also gearing up to work the walleye spawn at Willard, and they will be interviewing for our West Box Elder District, which is currently vacant. In our outreach section, the outreach folks participated in a recruitment, retention, and reactivation workshop. It's called the R3 effort, and that was a statewide workshop, and essentially trying to brainstorm ideas on how to recruit, retain, and reactivate hunters, anglers, and wildlife watchers, and the shooting sports. The outreach folks are also holding meetings with the community fisheries. Cities that have community fisheries, getting organized for those. And then there will be, or has been, some localized flooding up at Hardware Ranch as a result of heavy runoff and rain. So they're bracing for additional heavy runoff as we approach spring. In the wildlife section, they're starting their sage-grouse and sharp-tailed lek counts, and also starting their spring deer and pronghorn classifications. If you'd like to get out and participate in any of those, I'd encourage you to contact Randy Wood. And then they also have scheduled a spring range assessment where they essentially go out and just look at the condition of the range, spend some time with our habitat biologist, and brainstorm about different possible habitat projects. And then, as you're all probably aware, we initiated an emergency deer feeding effort this year. I want to really thank the sportsman organizations that came out and participated. We had a lot of good help there. We had a lot of just general volunteers from the community come out and lend a hand. And those that lived through the 2007-2008 feeding effort remember that it's not an easy task. And so I want to convey our appreciation from the agency to those that assisted with that emergency deer feeding effort. Without your assistance, we couldn't have pulled it off. But just to give you a few numbers, in our Rich County, Bear Lake area, and then also in South Rich, down by Woodruff and Randolph, we had 23 feeding locations, fed approximately 1,180 deer, and went through about 55 tons of product. In Cache Valley, we had 53 feeding stations, fed 1,680 deer, and went through about 40 tons of product. And in Box Elder County, we had 12 feeding stations, fed about 1,300 deer, and went through about 18 tons of product. And then in the Ogden Valley, we had 8 feeding locations, fed about 810 deer, and went through 10 tons of product. And then Camas, we had 5 feeding locations, fed about 710 deer, and went through 5 tons of product. So here in the region, as a total, we had a little over 100 feeding stations, fed approximately 5,680 deer, and went through about 128 tons of product. So it was not a small undertaking, and again, I want to express our appreciation to all those that helped. In our Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program, our waterfowl management areas are bracing for some pretty good heavy spring runoff. The folks on the project also installed a remote camera out on Gunnison Island to monitor the pelican colony. You can actually probably just Google Pelicam, and it'll give you a link to actually view live feed of what's going on at Pelican or at Gunnison Island. And the pelicans are starting to come back in now, and it's kind of neat to see all these little white dots appear and move around and then get up and fly off. It's a neat little effort. A little bit of an update on the Great Salt Lake. On December 1st, the railroad was prepared to take away the earthen berms on either side of the new bridge they had built that would allow the south arm of the Great Salt Lake to again start to flow into the northwest arm of the Great Salt Lake, north and west of Promontory. That part of the lake had been isolated from the main stem of the lake for about 4 years. And so at the time those berms were removed, there was about a 3.5-foot difference in elevation. The first week and a half, the south arm dropped about 0.3 foot, and the north arm rose almost 1 foot. And then we started into this real wet, rainy cycle, and the south arm started coming up, and the north arm really started coming up. And so as of today, the south arm is about 2 foot above its summer low, and the north arm is a little over 4 feet above the summer low. So now those two arms of the Great Salt Lake will continue to exchange water and hopefully bring back some dynamics to particularly the brine situation in Great Salt Lake. And I tried to make a forecast on where the lake will go, but I don't even dare do that, because every time we start to kind of warm up and dry out, we get another storm. But I would imagine at least 2.5 to 3 feet of additional rise wouldn't be unheard of. In our habitat section, they're presenting proposals for the Watershed Restoration Initiative projects. We've got several good projects here in the region that we're proposing for this year. Our WMAs that have winter closures will open on the 8th of April this year, which is an early opening, because it's usually the second Saturday in April that the WMAs open up. And then they'll also be helping with the spring range assessments with the wildlife section. And in our aquatic section, they're currently spawning walleye at Willard. They've spawned about 200 walleye, and it's yielded about 8.5 million eggs. These eggs are going to be used to raise fry. There are some of which will be fertile fry and some of which will be sterile fry, and they'll be used to stock back into other areas within the state. As far as fishing goes right now, the streams are running high, so stream fishing is kind of out of the question, but the reservoirs are fishing quite well. Rockport's fishing well, East Canyon, Lost Creek, they're all fishing quite well, so I'd encourage you to get up and take advantage of that. The last thing that I had for the aquatic section is they are trying to reconnect the Weber, the small tributaries to the Weber River to try to preserve this fluvial Bonneville cutthroat that spawns up these real small tributaries, but then comes back and spends most of its life in the main stem. And so whenever there's a road crossing or a culvert, some of these have become impediments to the actual spawn, and so they were successful in reconnecting the Strawberry Creek to the Weber River through a series of fish ladders. It's a culvert that's kind of canted at a 15-degree angle, but it's canted enough that the fish can't swim up, so they put in these ladders on the one side that slows the velocity down and allows the fish to go back up and access Strawberry Creek. So good project, and they completed that, I believe, last week. So that's all I have, unless there's questions.
Hey, Justin, do you have an approximate cost of what it takes to feed deer in northern Utah this past winter?
You know, Randy, yeah, why don't you give us a little bit of an update on cost? Randy didn't give me any cost figures, but
we're about $60,000 for the deer feeding effort. So
thanks, Justin.
Any other questions? All right, thanks. I'd like to give you a little rundown on the standard operating procedure for our meeting. The meeting will proceed as follows. We will have a presentation by a representative of the Division of Wildlife Resources, and then we will have questions from the public, and that's an opportunity for you to ask questions only. And then we will turn to the council for questions on the presentation. Then we will move back to the public for comments on the agenda item. And persons representing themselves will be allowed 3 minutes to comment. If you represent a group, organized group, you'll be allowed 5, and Bryce will make the timing there. In either case, we ask that you fill out a blue comment card. They're available in the back of the room, and pass those up so we can have a record of your comment for the minutes. We'll then move over to the council, which will then comment on the agenda item, and then we will have motions for the action item. I will remind the council members, if you wish to abstain from voting, you'll make sure and you state your conflict so that we have a record of that. And then also, if you are in opposition to the vote, that we ask for your reasoning on those items. Any questions regarding that? Okay, so then we'll go ahead and begin with the first action item on the Bucks, Bulls, and Once-in-a-Lifetime recommendations for 2017, and Justin Shannon will provide our presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Tonight I'm going to present the Bucks Bulls Once-in-a-Lifetime recommendations for 2017. So to begin, we'll start out with mule deer. Last year was a great year for mule deer hunters on general season units throughout the state. We harvested just shy of 32,000 bucks, and that's as high a number as we've had since 1996, when we harvested close to 33,000 bucks, and we did it with 16,000 fewer hunters in the field. And so, you know, what we saw was high success rates, a lot of mature bucks that were coming through the check stations, and high satisfaction rates. It was just a great year for deer hunting in Utah. If you look at our buck-to-doe ratio trends over the last 20, 25 years or so, early 90s, statewide, we'd have about 7 to 8 bucks per 100 does when we summarized our fall classification. And about the year 2000 or so, we hovered around 15 bucks per 100 does for a little over a decade. And then from about 2011 on, we really increased buck-to-doe ratios, where last year we were at 23, and this year, in fall of 2016, that number dropped down to 21. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is the increased harvest that we saw, and the other was some of the drought conditions that we had in many pockets of the state. And these sideboards, what you'll see with the yellow lines, this is what we manage for on the general season units, either 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does or 18 to 20. So again, buck-to-doe ratios are still doing very well in Utah, even with the dip from last year. If you look at fawn production trends, we've had some peaks and valleys since the early 2000s, but the last 8 years, fawn production has really been stable between about 60 and 65 fawns per 100 does. This last year, we took a little dip. We're about 59 statewide, and you know, anything at or above 60, right around that neighborhood, is pretty good. Some deer status. These are some slides that I generally don't present in RAC meetings. It's more informational, but I think it's important to tell the story and to kind of give the why behind some of our recommendations that you'll hear tonight. If you look at the winter of 2015-16, not this year, but last year, it was difficult in many pockets of the state. And I don't even know if a hard winter is the right word. I think we had a winter. I mean, we went 4 years with just such a light winter in the state that our deer were just doing exceptionally well, and we grew 100,000 deer during that time frame. But it was tougher in some pockets of Utah. And if you look in the northern part of the state, we had close to 30% fawn survival. If you look at the cache, it was 27% of our fawns survived. Same thing with the Oker Stansberries and the Wasatch Mountains. A Manti was about 31% fawn survival. So these were bucks that would have been brought into the population and been available for harvest that we didn't have, and that's different than the previous 4 or 5 years, so I wanted to highlight that. If you look at where we've been this last winter, over the last 4 months or so, we've had low fawn survival in many parts of the state. And units like the cache, you know, this will be 2 years in a row, consecutive years with limited recruitment coming into the population, so fewer of these yearling bucks being available for harvest. In addition, I think Justin did a great summary of the deer feeding efforts on the units and the box elder cache, Camas, and Ogden. And again, it just highlights and reiterates some of the challenges that we, and when I say we, the division and sportsmen and the public came together on to try to help deer. And I want to take a minute and thank those that helped with the feeding effort. I know there's individuals in this room, and I know many of your neighbors and fellow sportsmen, they really stepped up. I mean, this is an effort that the division just couldn't take on its own, and we really appreciate it. It shows the passion and the dedication and the teamwork that goes into this. So big thanks to those that were involved. I can't say enough about it. So getting back to the recommendations, what we're recommending this year statewide is a decrease of about 1,600 permits, or just over 89,000 total. Because we manage on 29 different units, we're recommending no change on 12 units, increases on 5, and decreases on 12. And we'll summarize that as we go through each region. So if we start with the northern region, on the far left we have the unit, so the Chalk Creek, Morgan, Camas, Ogden, those types of units, and then the objective, what we're managing for, either 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does or 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does. Next, we have the 3 years and their buck-to-doe ratio from the fall classification, and the 3-year average there that is highlighted in green. And when you see things highlighted in green, it means that we're above the objective or we're recommending an increase. And when you see things in yellow, it generally means we're below objective or we're recommending some sort of decrease. So on the far right, you can see on the Ogden, the Box Elder, and the Cache, we're recommending permit decreases on these 3 units. And overall for the region, it's a decrease of about 900 permits total. Moving on to the central region, recommending decreases in permits on the Nebo, Oker Stansberries, and Wasatch Mountains West units. Some of these have declining trends in the buck-to-doe ratio, And some of these have had harder winters as well with fawn production, or I'm sorry, fawn survival. And so overall in the central region, recommending a decrease of 300 permits. In the southern region, the southern region's not doing so bad. We are recommending decreases on two of the plateau units, the boulders and the fish lake. Pretty sharp declines on the fish lake there and the buck to doe ratio in the 1 year. But the rest of the units are doing well, so either recommending no change or slight increases on several of these. Overall, though, it's about a 400 permit increase from last year. In the southeast region, recommending a decrease on the Central Mountains Manti. That's a unit that went from 23 bucks per 100 does to 16 in 1 year, and it's still doing well on the three-year average, excuse me, but they had low fawn survival in that year and a pretty drastic drop in buck-to-doe ratio. I want to get out ahead of that. But we're recommending increases on the San Juan Abajo Mountains. Their buck-to-doe ratios are doing really well, as are their populations. Then finally, the northeast region. The south slope units had a very difficult winter, not just seeing losses in fawn survival, or decreases in fawn survival, but adult survival in some of those areas too. And recommending overall about a decrease of about 500 permits for the northeast region. Moving on to premium limited entry deer, these would be the Hanneries and the Ponsagunt units. We manage for an age objective. And so what we'd like to see is 40% or greater of the deer that are harvested to be 5 years or older. Both of these units are doing great. They're doing well in that regard. And as a result, recommending no change in permits on these units. We also manage these units to a buck-to-doe ratio. And if we're exceeding the buck-to-doe ratio, we'll increase management buck hunts. Management hunt is where you can harvest a buck with 3 points or less on one side. And if we're below that objective, we would decrease permits. And so as you can see, the Henry's has a three-year average of about 53 bucks per 100 does, and the Ponsagunt's trending in a good direction. They're about 49. And so with that, we're recommending an increase of 6 permits on the Ponsagunt from 25 to 31. And also on the Henry's, we're keeping it at 30 permits. But in December, the Wildlife Board approved 2 new hunts. One is an archery hunt that would be for management buck hunt, and the other would be for a muzzleloader. So we're just splitting those permits, 9, 12, and 9. Let's see, moving on to the rest of the limited entry units, there is just not a lot of movement across the board. These units are right where they need to be with their buck-to-doe ratios. And in some cases, they're exceeding, but we did pretty good increases in permits from last year. And so, really, on all of our typical limited entry units, we're not recommending any changes in permits. If you look at our late season muzzleloader hunts, these are hunts that occur on general season units in early November, and hunters have to use a muzzleloader. And these are designed for units that are exceeding 20 bucks per 100 does in the three-year average. We added 3 new units, the Mount Dutton, the Ogden, and the Plateau Fish Lake last year. And then we're recommending an increase of 10 permits on the 9 mile. So overall, when you look at the limited entry deer permits, recommending an increase of 25, all of which are on that late season muzzleloader hunt. Moving on to elk. Recommending no change in permits from the spike any bull and youth any bull hunts. Statewide, the success rates on the 2016 spike hunt was 15%, which is good. Anything under 20 is what we're happy with. And the statewide elk plan sets these number of permits in that plan. Moving on to limited entry elk, statewide we're recommending an increase of 81 permits, or about a 3% increase. If you break that down by the different age categories, these units here on the far left, these are the ones that we manage for 7.5 to 8-year-old bull in the harvest. And we're recommending a slight decrease on the Book Cliffs Little Creek because of a declining trend there, and an increase on the San Juan with 3 years in a row of average age above 8. Overall, though, it's for this age category, it's a decrease of 1. Looking at 6.5 to 7-year-old units, everything's just kind of going up or down a little bit on this. So we're recommending increases on the Bitter Creek, the Monroe, the Diamond Mountain, and the Southwest Desert, and decreases on the other units. Some of these If you see a star by the name, some of this is because the age objective was changed when we redid the statewide elk plan. And so we're increasing or decreasing permits in order to manage that new objective. If you look at the 5.5 to 6-year-old units, recommending increases on the Central Mountains Manti, LaSalle's, Anthro, and the Wasatch Mountains, all of which are exceeding their average or just trending in a really good direction for us. And then we're recommending a decrease on the North Slope Three Corners. And then finally, for the 4.5 to 5 units, recommending a slight decrease on the Pilot Mountains and the Cache North units, but increases on the Ponsagant and the Grouse Creek. Moving on to pronghorn. Overall, pronghorn are doing really well, especially in some of our desert country in southeast Utah, southern Utah, the West Desert. Throughout the state, everything seems to be headed in a good direction for these animals. So we're recommending about a 10% increase in permits from 771 to 849. And moving on to the once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations. For moose, we're recommending no change in permits at the statewide level. Bison, pretty healthy increase from 96 to 148. A lot more opportunity on the Book Cliffs as that population grows, and the Henrys as well. That population's doing well. Increasing 11 more, recommending an increase of 11 more desert bighorn tags. All of our surveys are up, and that's good news for sportsmen. Slight decrease in Rocky Mountain bighorn permits, and adding 4 more to mountain goats. In addition to this, the Wildlife Board, as was mentioned in the update, they approved an archery-only bison hunt and a mountain goat hunt, and the permits that we'd recommend for the Henry's bison hunt is 10, and that Central Mountain, Hyuna Central mountain goat hunt would be 2. And that's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Justin. Questions from the public? Good-oak. Seeing none. Questions from the rack?
Justin, you might have mentioned it, and I just missed it. What are the increments on the reduction of tags in the Box Elder, Cache, and Ogden percentage of archery, muzzleloader, and rifle? What's the breakdown on that? If you had it, I didn't see it.
I didn't mention that. So what it is it's if we have 100 tags, 60 of them go to rifle hunters, 20% go to archery, 20% go to muzzleloader. So on the cache, if we decrease 500 permits like we're recommending, it would be 300 rifle permits, 100 archery, 100 muzzleloader.
So it's so, okay. Yeah. I just was curious the breakdown. Thanks,
yeah,
Justin.
Yeah, it's just in proportion. I'll throw that out.
Justin, I'm looking at some stats that you provided to us on the status of the herd, and it looks like the status of the elk herd sized the population dropped just minimally, just like a half a percentage size of the population. But the number of antlerless elk permits dropped by 3,700, which is a huge number. Are we making them up somewhere else, or what is the reason for such a over 25% drop?
We are, and I'll explain the whys with that with the next presentation when I get into antlerless, but it's not that we're just cutting these permits. We're shifting how we obtain antlerless harvest, and I'll try to explain that better in my next presentation for you.
So once again, I'm a woman ahead of my time. I'm just asking my question too early.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, we're not just ignoring the harvest. We'll get it. Yeah.
Justin, could you, back to the total number of deer tags in the state of Utah from 2016 to this coming 2017, what was the difference again? So we're...
About 1,600, yeah.
Okay. Do we know how many people applied for those? How many people got an unsuccessful and did not get a deer tag? Do we have numbers on the number of application as to number of permits?
Yeah. Steve, you're raising your hand? Yeah. Not just in life. We're talking about... Yeah. Okay. Now, off the cusp, I think we had about 137,000 people apply for general season permits. And I might be wrong on that. That's the number that comes here, so take that with a grain of salt. But every year we tend to be increasing on that. So our demand gets higher and higher every year. I think this year we had about an 8% increase in the number of people that applied for big game permits across the board. And so I can look that up, but I don't have it now. So, yeah. I don't, Kobe, can you text Lindy and see how many people applied for general season? Just deer. How many general season people? We'll try to get it tonight. I just don't have it off the top of my head. So,
any other questions?
I got a question. We got surprisingly few comments from the public this time around, but one I think that everybody got was in regards to the permit allocation for the limited entry. Particularly, this person was interested in the Henry Mountains, mm-hmm. talking about that 60-20-20 split.
Right.
In this individual's case, there are apparently only 6 or 7 people that have maximum bonus points, but all the rifle hunters are getting all the permits every year, and these people that are applying for the archer or the muzzleloader, you've got everybody fighting over the one tag that's
correct.
Allocated. Is there a bonus tag system? Is that 60-20-20 split set in statute somewhere?
No, it's not. It's in the management plan, so we put it there that we'd manage for 60-20-20. Unless there was a management-related purpose, something we're trying to accomplish. And we vary from that. Like on the Zion unit, we've got some real crowding issues. So as we've increased permits, we put those more into archery and muzzleloader. But in this case, I think this is a little different than the 60-20-20 allocation. This is more how we do the bonus point draw.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of hunts with our bighorn sheep, and a lot of hunts we don't get to 15 permits. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Generally, what we do is we give 90% of the permits to the residents and 10% of the permits to the non-residents. And so a lot of our hunts have 10 permits. So the Henry Mountains, I think they have 9 or 10 archery permits.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, we have one that just goes to non-residents. And so as you do that, that permit is available to everybody in that applicant pool. It doesn't go to the person with the most points. And that's where this conversation is stemming from, is how do we get it to where they can use their max points for that? To me, there's not a simple solution for it. I'd hate to take it from the residents and give another one to a non-resident so they can maximize that max point. And it's a tougher one. But part of me has a hard time feeling bad about it, because we have so many hunts that have bonus points and can do this. And certainly they can put in for the rifle hunt. If they want to use a bow, they could use a bow. I there's not an easy fix to what we're getting at. It's supply demand.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to be insensitive to that. You just can't add tags to these systems is what we're up against.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move to the public for comment. Do we have any comment cards? Okay. No comments. RAC, comments and or motion? Bryce.
I think the biggest thing on why we don't see any comments is because these guys overall are doing such an awesome job. I'm not going to give any credit to Justin, but his team does a fabulous job overall. So, I mean, I think that's just kudos. I think, you know, when you see a lot of fighting and bickering, there's problems usually. When it goes smooth, these guys are doing an awesome job and everybody's happy. So kudos to you on that.
I'll make the motion. We accept the plan as presented.
You have a second? Second from John. Okay, any discussion on the motion? Okay, so the motion is to accept the division's plan as presented for the Bucks and Bulls and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations for 2017. All those in favor indicate by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Unanimous. Motion passes. Thanks, Justin. Next is the antlerless permit recommendations for 2017.
Justin, do you have an
answer? What is it?
It's not broken down by species yet.
Come on up to the mic, Cove.
So we kind of have the answer. It's not broken down by species yet, but it looks like we had around 460,000 total big game applications.
How does that compare to last year? Does it say?
It's up. I think it's up. Okay. For about the 8% you said.
8% from last year, okay. Hey, Kobe, will you follow me out to the parking lot? Because I made fun of Steve, and he's a lot bigger than me.
So he can beat us both up?
Yeah. Yes. So. This got awkward. Okay. Tonight I'm going to present the antlerless recommendations for 2017. Again, we'll start out with deer. Showed this slide in the last presentation, but again, our fawn production has been relatively stable for the last several years, and this year we took a little dip, 59 fawns per 100 does. So it's not alarming, but it's also not the trend that we want to see. If you look at the statewide survival rates, ever since 2010, that time frame, we've gone out and we've radio-collared deer on about 7 units throughout the state, and radio-collared female fawns and does. And what we've got is, from that information is, or from that data is, great information on survival. And so the yellow line there at the top, that's adult survival. And so we've varied between about 80 and 86% adult survival every year. Generally, you want to be into that mid to low 80s survival rate for adults, and that's really good for a deer population. And the fawns, this is what I was saying earlier in my Bucks Bulls presentation. Last year we had 43% fawn survival, which is the lowest it's been in this time frame that we've had radio collars out. But we're kind of comparing it to 4 just exceptional years where you had 80% fawn survival. And when you look at that, what that really equates to is just exceptional growth in our deer herds. And we've seen it in the agency, sportsmen have seen it. Our harvest is showing that. If you look at how our deer populations have peaked and valleyed over the last several years, we've had our ups and downs. And since about 2011, we've had a lot of ups. But given the fawn survival, the adult survival, and the fawn production that we had last year, we estimate that we dropped about 10,000 deer in the state in 2016. If you look at public draw permits for antlerless deer, we used to have gobs of them. I mean, I should probably show this graph way back when we had several thousand. But the last, in the recent future, we've gotten away with that, gotten away from that, and used a lot more depredation permits. And as our deer herds have grown, so have the pressures on agricultural lands, and in some cases, range lands on these winter ranges. And so this year we're recommending an increase in permits from 755 to just shy of 1,500. If you look at where these are, the why behind these recommendations, we use antlerless deer hunts to address depredation situations that we have or rangeland concerns. And in the southern region where we've grown a lot of deer, this is where, in this case, all the permits are being recommended. So overall, we're recommending a slight decrease in the beaver unit, and then the rest of those southern region units, quite a bit of increase. We're also recommending some new hunts, a few on the Monroe, several on the Pine Valley, a couple on the Plateau, and another one on Zion, Northwest Zion, and a slight boundary change on the Pine Valley Enterprise. Moving on to elk. So this has been good. Over the last 4 or 5 years, our populations have stabilized, as was mentioned earlier. And this year they decreased again by about 1,500 elk in the state. Our current estimate is just shy of 78,000, and our population objective is just above 78,000. And this population objective changed in November and December when we brought unit plans through the rack and board process. We increased those population objectives in many areas throughout the state with the help of committees and these unit management plans. If you look at the public draw permits, this is a really interesting table because it looks like we really got into elk in 2013, and now we're really getting away from that elk harvest. And it's not entirely the case. When we were increasing permits pretty rapidly in 2012 and 2013 because we were over objective. And one thing that we learned is oftentimes on these units, when you throw more permits at it, you don't always harvest more elk. In some cases, you just lower hunter success rates and lower satisfaction as well. And so really this graph is a credit to the local biologists and wildlife managers throughout the state that took a different approach, and they said, we're going to try to be smarter with our hunts, have better boundaries, have better season dates, and the goal is to increase success rates. It's not about selling permits. It's really about getting the harvest that we need, and we've done that with decreases in these public draw permits. I mean, the same years that we've cut public draw permits, we've increased our harvest as well, and our populations have been stable. So this year, we're recommending a decrease in permits from 13,680 to just shy of 10,000. If you look at the northern region, we'll break this down by region. On the far left, you have the unit, and then the current population objective, and the current population estimate, and then last year's permits and what we're recommending this year. So in the northern region, we're recommending 40 more permits on the cache unit and decreases on the Box Elder, Ogden, and Morgan Southridge units. The other thing we're doing is we're changing one of the names on the cache to the cache east. And the reason we're doing this is because we have a boundary for deer that's called the cache, and we have a boundary for elk that's called the cache, and they're different boundaries. And so to avoid confusion with the hunters, that's kind of one of the approaches we're taking. Moving on to the central region, recommending increases on the Nebo and the Wasatch Mountains West units. We're also calling for a new hunt on the Wasatch Mountains West Central. This will be with a muzzleloader in early November. And also another name change there. We have two hunts called Wasatch Mountains West, one's for deer, one's for elk, so we're trying to clean that up. I think that just reiterates how non-creative we are. We have so many hunts that have the same name. We got to think better now. Southern region, recommending increases in permits on the Mount Dutton and the Fish Lake Thousand Lakes units, and really no changes or decreases in some of the other units in southern region. If you look at some of the new hunts and boundary changes, recommending new hunts on the Beaver North and East, the Mount Dutton Plateau, the Last Chance Desert on the Santa Fe and Plateau units, and Hatch Banch. And then finally, another name change on Fillmore Oak Creek. Southeast region, recommending decreases in permits on the San Juan and the Central Mountains Manti. In your rack packet, there's two hunts on the San Juan that we've since made some other decisions on. So we're recommending, even though it's in your rack packet, we're recommending eliminating two of those San Juan hunts. It's about 150 permits, just because that unit's at 1,000 and we're trying to get it to 1,300. And so apologize for that difference. We just didn't want to send out two rack packets at the last minute. So also recommending a new hunt, the Central Mountains Farron Canyon Southeast, and a boundary change to Moreland Stump Flat. For the northern region, northeast region, pretty good decreases in permits on the South Slope, Yellowstone, Diamond Mountain areas, and the Wasatch, the Current Creek, and Aviniquin areas as well. And no new hunts or boundary changes are being proposed tonight. Those are the public draw permits, as was talked about earlier. And it's true, there are decreases about 3,800 permits. But we also have other avenues to get harvest, and some of these are over-the-counter. And this is kind of a shift in philosophy for us. We're going more this route. So we have our antlerless elk control permits, which is an over-the-counter permit. And this is where a hunter can harvest an antlerless elk using the same weapon type during the same season dates and within areas of overlap between their antlerless elk control permit and their bucks bulls once-in-a-lifetime permit. And then we also have private lands only permits. We initiated these this last year, got some good feedback on them, got a lot of harvest as well, and not just numbers-wise, but harvest in the right areas. And so that's been fruitful also. So if you look at antlerless elk control, last year we had this on 11 units. We sold about 4,000 permits, harvested about 500 elk. Not a great success rate, but a lot of areas where these hunts are taking place, the objective is zero. And so it's opportunistic. If you see an elk and can harvest it, great. You don't have to, you're already in the field with a buck or bull tag anyways. This year we're recommending this take place on the Camas and a slight boundary change on the San Juan. For private lands only permits, again, last year was our first time issuing these. We sold about 2,800, harvested about 1,450 elk, and success rate was about 52%. This was well received by the landowners and the hunters that were able to obtain these tags and make that work out. And it really simplified the process in many ways. If someone had elk on their property, if they lacked tolerance for that, they could go to Walmart and buy permits and get the harvest, and and we kind of stayed out of it. And that simplified a lot of things, and it minimized a lot of depredation challenges that we had, especially in the northeast part of the state. We heard a lot of really good feedback from that region. And it really helped to redistribute elk on the landscape for us as well. It pushed some of these elk back onto public lands where they were seeking refuge on private lands. So if you look at the units in green, these are the units that we're recommending new this year for private lands only permits: the Central Mountains Nebo, Mount Denton, Panguitch Lake, and the Zion units. And overall, we're recommending just shy of 9,000 permits. So in summary, we're modifying the way that we harvest cow elk in the state. There is a decrease in public draw permits, but we're adding additional antlerless elk control units and increasing the number of units where private land permits are being offered as well. Moving on to doe pronghorn, recommending an increase of about 120 permits statewide. Some of this area where we're recommending an increase is on the Pilot Mountain and Promontory units on the Box Elder and the Mount Denton Ponsagat unit as well. Also recommending some new hunts: Box Elder Promontory, Box Elder West, Mount Denton Ponsagat, and the Plateau Parker Mountain, a couple hunts out there. And then finally, antlerless moose permits. Not a lot of movement, just recommending two additional permits on the Ogden West, where that population's doing well. And that's all I have for antlerless. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Justin. Okay, we'll take questions from the public. Questions from the rack.
Yeah, Russ. You know, Justin, going back to one of the early slides on fawn survival.
Yeah.
You know, we've done a lot of habitat projects down in the south and also in Box Elder and on Winter Range and so forth. And they've been going on for a while now. Is there differences in fawn survival where those projects have taken place? Yeah. And some of those, you know, some of those units in southern Utah have a lot of, you know, lower elevation, you know, juniper treatments where a lot of sage comes up and so forth. Whereas northern region, you know, we have development that climbs up pretty high and the deer are kind of forced to winter a little higher. I mean, are there differences? Can you see differences with those projects?
Kent, do you want to come up and talk about what we're doing to answer that question? We got time. We'll take a minute.
Okay, so to answer your question regarding fawn survival, that's going to be a real tricky one. Our sample sizes for fawns are only set at 20 to minimize cost and essentially time of capture as well. So it really just gets us high, medium, low. So we're not set up to look at differences in fawn survival. That said, we have a large-scale effort going on right now with the switch over to GPS collars we've done on all deer. We're looking at the amount of time does use these habitat treatments, and we also can assess in December and in March how fat these animals are by capturing them using an ultrasound. So we're able to see essentially what condition they are, what kind of habitat they're doing, and how that relates to how fat that deer is, what habitat. So.
Yeah.
So, thanks, Ken. I mean, I know
And then I guess the only thing else, body condition is related to the next year's fawn survival of that doe.
Right.
So we will get at that. We can get at use of fawns of these habitat treatments as well, but we really don't have enough data to relate that back to too many metrics on the fawn itself.
Okay. Yeah. Great.
Russ, Kent's being modest. He's he's going to do a big project for us that looks at deer and if they use these habitat treatment areas versus those that don't, and look at the body condition scores and tie that to survival for adults, not so much for fawns. But it's something as an agency we're really excited to see, and he'll be spearheading that, and it's going to be cool. We'll have better results here in a couple of years, but yeah, we're getting right at that question.
No, so. It is good, and you know, I bet the bulk of the public have no idea how much research is going on with deer right now, you know, from the division. So
yeah.
Division needs to be commended on all the research that is going on.
Yeah. Thank you.
Chris, did you have one?
Sorry.
Justin, let's go back to the antlerless permits. And
for
there
elk?
Was, yes, for elk.
Yeah.
Thank
okay.
you. So from that peak in 2013, when there were nearly 18,000 permits offered,
yeah.
Some of the drop This, between 2016 and 2017, is made up by other permits being offered on private lands and such. However, you said that this is specifically a management technique to increase hunters' success rate.
Correct.
Is there a corresponding chart that shows the increase in hunter success rate from 2013 to 2017?
No.
When we started dropping those public permits?
No, not a great chart. And the reason is because this year I think we're only adding six new elk hunts, and every year we turn off elk hunts. And I would say out of all the big game management strategies that we have, elk unit boundaries and elk hunt, antlerless elk hunts are probably some of the most fluid. We've had times where we've shut off 20 hunts at a time and added 15 or so new hunts, and so it's really hard to compare. But at the at a statewide, here's what all the success rates have done. But at the unit level, we had hunts. I'll give you an example. So we had hunts on the Wasatch unit where hunter success rate was 6%, and so we had a ton of hunters out there, and they came back and said, you guys sold us a camping trip is what you sold us. It wasn't, there were no elk. There weren't a lot of these things. And so now, our hunter success rates are closer to 50%. And so that's not in a graph, but that's kind of what we're getting at. And so it doesn't always represent that we haven't harvested less elk because of the cuts. We've just gotten smarter about how to go about it. So it would be hard to pull all that together because some are being turned on and off so frequently. Yeah.
Thank you.
Bryce. So, I know that's not a great answer, but that's...
Back to that, your survey. Didn't you guys get a bunch of money this year from the legislature for GPSing collars and a bunch of stuff like that so you could actually study these even more in depth?
I haven't heard from the legislature. Have you heard anything, Justin?
I heard from a...
Yeah,
source up there that's what was the case.
No, we're dedicating a bunch of Pittman Robinson money, which are federal funds that they're almost like a match to sportsmen that sportsmen's permits, and internally we're dedicating quite a bit of money to that, and then we're going to work with our sportsmen groups to fund a portion of it as well. But it's going to be a big effort. What we are going to do is start a what we call a wildlife migration initiative. Is this kind of what you're getting at? Yeah, and we have goals to radio collar a lot more deer, a lot more elk populations, a lot of species, and not just big game, fish, other things, avian species, predators, those types of things, to get more information on movement, survival rates, and it'll be the foundation for a better management system. So, Justin.
I have another question. As far as the public land cow tags, now that we've had 1 year of doing them, you mentioned just in your comments that, the biggest purpose or reason that you did them was to try to help get some of the cow elk that were on private ground to get them off.
Yeah.
The number of tags, was there 9,000? Is that what I saw close to, 9,000?
Yeah, we're recommending 9,000, yeah.
Last year, how many did you?
We recommended 12,000 last year, but we only sold 2,800.
That was my question. So you sold 2,800 last year. So if you recommend, so that 9,830, does that include those private land?
No. So private lands only permits. These are separate than the public draw. We're recommending about nine. I think there's a couple things. One is it was so new, a lot of people didn't know what it was. So I don't want to buy it if I'm not sure how it's going to work. My guess is it gets more popular this year. And even for us internally, we're like, we hope this works. We hope it has an effect. And your question about shifting distribution of animals from public to private, I've got a slide here at the end. It's really not part of the presentation, but I threw it in here just in case this comes up. On the far left here, what you have is the percentage of elk that are on public land. And this is starting from January 1st all the way to the archery elk opener. And as you can see, we had 75% of the elk that were on public land. And it's incredible to me. As soon as these hunts start, these elk, man, they find refuge. And oftentimes that's on private lands. And we have times in the middle of the deer hunt where we only have 25% of our radio-collared elk on public land. And so the sportsmen are saying, what is happening? I have this lower hunt success or lower success rate hunt, we've got to do something different. And that was 2015 when we didn't have private lands only permits. The next year, these are the data from last year, same elk, Wasatch, and surrounding units. Again, they start coming off when the elk hunts start. But if you look at the drop at the same time period that we were at 25% of the elk on public land last year, during that same time frame with the private lands only permits, that number is about 38%. And so in 1 year, we've shifted the distribution of elk by about 13% on that. And so, you know, is that the silver bullet? No, but it's helping. And it's helping it so when we turn on more public hunts, because we will, we're going to have to add more public hunts down the road. But those elk will not feel comfortable on private lands, and they'll have higher success rates on public lands.
And then if they buy a private lands tag, that's good for, I mean, what's any private ground, whether it be
yeah.
5 acre parcel, they can get that and go shoot an elk in their yeah. backyard somewhere. It doesn't matter.
Well, I wouldn't do it in downtown Brigham City, but yeah, you could. I
know where you grew up.
I'm not going to self-incriminate, but the as long as it's in that boundary, it doesn't matter if it's a 5 acre parcel and it's legal to harvest, and if it's legal to discharge a firearm there, yeah, you can do it. There's no special regulations. It's about as simple as we could have made it. Private land on that unit, you can harvest an elk. So,
any other questions from the room? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move to the public for comment, and we have one card, Jerry Woodland.
My comment is geared more about the length of a season and the stress put on elk. I don't know if it fits in with the subject of the meeting tonight, but I hear a lot of comments about stress and antler gathering during the spring, and we have a late season cow hunt that starts in August in the Cache, Richmond, and Hyde Park. And that hunt ends the end of January, January 31st. It's not there's not a lot of opportunity to kill one of those elk, but in my observation of the elk in that unit and the stress they're likely to encounter, deep snow and hunters hunting clear into the end of January, just seems a little much to me. The other thing I noticed is sometimes the hunter behavior is a little bit suspect too. When these animals get down on private land and start crossing highways, it's amazing what's happened a couple of times in the last few years. Guys surround them and start chasing them around. And I would just, my comment is I'd like to consider you shortening the length of that hunt, which seems kind of crazy for a hunter to ask for a hunt to be shorter, but maybe possibly end that at the end of December when the chances of snow is not so high in that high country. That hunt actually began this year, the 1st of August. So I don't know if you'd consider that, and I don't know what forum that's actually where you'd, we're going to determine the season lengths, but the stress on elk in January with snow up to their bellies and hunters chasing around seems a little bit much to me on a hunt that began in August.
Okay, thank you. We set those dates in what month is that usually?
So if it's a buck bull or once-in-a-lifetime season date, that's in November.
Okay.
But what he's referring to here tonight with an antlerless season date, in the rack packet that you have with you, it'll have the permit number, which you're approving tonight, and the season dates as well. And so if you want to discuss season dates, that's on the table.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Any other comments? We don't have any other cards. All right, moving to the rack for comments. Mike?
Justin, is the reason for that hunt going clear till January 31st just for access to the elk? Because they're in accessible areas,
yeah.
So your harvest goes up because people can get to them.
I'll probably let the region answer that. There's so many antlerless elk hunts, and I'm less familiar with them than the biologists that recommended it.
Okay. I'm just speaking specifically to those that go to January 30th.
Yeah, oftentimes, like at the 30,000 foot view, Yeah, oftentimes we'll have hunts that go into January because elk will get in trouble. They'll be coming down to private lands or some of those things, and it's a way to
pressure.
Yeah, to pressure them back up higher on the mountain. But in this example, probably let the region tackle it where it's at this rack.
Jim Christensen, new cache biologist. Those season dates, they go later just so we can get adequate harvest on for the overall population. If we close it earlier, it's just harder to get the harvest that we need to maintain the population where we need it.
Jim, this is going to come like way out of left field. You wouldn't happen to have any information that would indicate what that harvest is, say, the last 15 days of that hunt? Is that where it's all happening? Is it that last 2 or 3 weeks of that hunt? Or is there enough of a harvest that late to warrant going to January 31st?
I don't have any of that data. I apologize.
Because if it was a small percentage and it wasn't, right. You know, I can see where he's coming from personally.
Justin.
He mentioned the close of the shed hunt, and I would say that allowing people to hunt elk on the hillside at the same time we're not allowing shed hunters on there would be kind of counterproductive to what we're trying to do. I know we're talking elk, but how is it affecting other animals as far as the deer? I'm not familiar with the area, but I'm assuming there's probably deer in those same foothills at that time, and so it would be something I think if we're going to for this year in general, we closed the shed hunt, probably should have been discussed and what may have been more successful, but I think it is something we should look at.
Yeah, thanks. Anything else? Any other comments? Bryce?
How hard, Justin, would it be to get some data for obviously if we don't make a decision today, but for next year that shows, when you showed your graph of where the cow elk were, the time of year, when's, I mean, do they report? They don't really report harvest days, do they? The date of harvest? So we can kind of track that?
No, it gets more challenging because we'll ask them how many days they hunted and some of those questions, but I'd have to go back and look. Ken, do you remember? We don't ask them what day they harvested on these hunts. Not that I recall.
Is that too much of a stretch to add that into the, I mean, if you're asking, add that as a date, because I mean, I think that's pretty valuable information, because if it was not, a huge, like you said, that last 15 or 20 days, and we could sacrifice that, it would be the benefit of the deer and elk.
Yeah, we can talk to Heather and see what we can work into the survey. We could ask it from an elk perspective. We're not really concerned. We run 94% elk survival across the state, regardless of how much pressure. They do very well in Utah, and we really don't see any variance in survival there. So, but the other thing is it's not going to be consistent from year to year. It depends what the January is like to see what that harvest is going to be. If it's really moderate in the early parts of that hunt and the elk are still up high, especially if roads get closed and the elk are still high, you're going to see success drop unless those elk come down. If we have a heavy snow and the elk come down, then yeah, you will see success increase quite a bit, and a lot of people will, who maybe not have filled at all, will probably take an elk in January.
But it'd be nice just to see what the success was up till December, until the end of December. Granted, January changes year to year, but just up to December, to see historically what it, if how much of the harvest is between August and December.
Yeah, we can certainly look into, I think a lot of the antler list is now done online. We can certainly look into maybe adding a question in there that says data kill or something like that. We'll have to check into it for you. I don't know off the top.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever really had the question before tonight on what day the harvest is, because it's, with all the hunts that we have, it's generally, what was your success rate, some of that more basic stuff. And let us find out.
Say what month, maybe.
Yeah,
what was your harvest? I mean, that kind of gives you a target month, I guess, maybe.
We can go back and talk to our biometrician. She oversees, the harvest surveys and some of that. And, we can do that.
Any other comments from the rack? Yeah, John.
As we talk about
these late hunts for the elk in the areas above Camas. We have millions and millions and millions of acres of summer range, but we have very limited winter range. And a lot of the elk hunters are tromping through the middle of the deer as they're going up to the elk, which are a little higher on the mountain. So I think that by hunting them clear into the end of January, we are stressing the deer. I think that elk are surviving, by what we know, but I think the deer are being stressed. And, they've been chased around since mid-August when the archery hunt started. So as we talk about that, I'd like to bring up the point that I think it would be a wise move to make on the part of the division to not allow shed hunting at all until the 1st of April every year, just to keep those animals calmed down and less stressed to them. I know I'm 1st of April would be a mad rush to see who got to the hill first, but I think it was a mad rush while we were feeding this year too until they shut them down, because the deer couldn't even come in to feed because there were people hounding the feed ground. So I think we need to think about, the elk are tough and we keep raising the objectives. The carrying capacities, we keep raising those, but we seem to always be bumping or over our objectives for elk. But I think it has a detrimental effect on deer that we need to think about a little more.
Any other comments? Craig, and then we'll move back to the public. We can grab another comment.
Yes, I'd like to comment. In my travels and in my observation, I think we need more elk on public land, and we need less elk in a lot of our private lands, maybe not everywhere, but in some of them we need less elk. And I'd just like to commend the Shannon and his group for their work and using some of the tools that are in the management plan to try to make that happen. And we can see some of that starting to happen with moving elk from private to public, and I just would like to comment on that and tell them to keep that up, and hopefully we can kind of get that balance where we want it. Thank you.
Thanks. We can move back to the public and could we get a card from you, though, after you make your comment? Go ahead.
Steve Sorensen. I've heard a lot of comments about the shed hunting, a few tonight. By putting the season in Utah, we pushed everybody to Nevada, parts of Colorado, Idaho. These areas are getting hammered. I buy and sell antlers for a living, and I'm on the up of knowing what's going on here and there in the different states. Nevada, I've seen it in newspapers, they're complaining about all the Utahns in Nevada this year. We just grew 100,000 deer in the last 5 years in this state with shed hunting. We've tried a season before, it didn't work. Idaho's tried a season, it didn't work. Nevada was going to try a season. They realized it wasn't going to work. I'd hate to see that. I'd hate to ever see a season in Utah unless it's like this year. And I'd like to really thank the division for putting a season on it this year where we're feeding deer. And I've talked to a few of you guys on the rack. And I think if we are feeding deer, it should be an automatic closure for that county. But just my 2 cents on it. Thank you.
Thanks. And don't forget to put out a comment for us. Thank you. Any other comments and or motion from the RAC regarding this action item? Bryce?
I'd just like to make a comment before I make a motion. But, I mean, I agree. I think that's definitely something that we need to look at on the DARE committee level. You know, we need to look at those season dates and, you know, maybe some of these other seasons, you know, the lengths of these seasons. But also the, you know, shed hunting, how it affects, you know. Granted, I know we've grown a lot of deer in the last 5 years, but we didn't have a winter like we did this year. And I think, you know, we're going to start to see a little bit of a decrease. But I hopefully the DARE committee, you know, will look at those, you know, at those possible seasons. But I'd like to make a motion we accept the division's recommendation as presented.
Okay, we have a motion from Bryce. We have a second from John. Any discussion?
Mike. Do we have to include that in the motion that we'd like to look at the season dates? Is that what Bryce did?
I heard the motion was to accept the division's.
Okay, then I'd like to have it amend it to include looking at the season dates on these late elk hunts and how they affect mule deer in time and place.
Is that?
Are you cool with that, Bryce?
Attention?
Yes.
Okay. So, can you restate your amendment then to that?
I'd like to accept the plan as presented, with the caveat that we will explore, I guess, season dates or the late elk hunts, I guess, got me in a weird spot. So, yeah, that we would explore the season dates and see if they're really necessary that we hunt them until January 31st, I guess. Is that okay that way? Yeah, make it that way.
Sure. Okay, so we have a motion by Bryce and a second by John. And do we have any other discussion regarding the motion? Okay, so the motion on the table then is to accept the division's presentation and to explore or to ask the division to explore season dates regarding this particular presentation. All those in favor, indicate by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? None. Motion carries unanimous. Great. All right. Thank you, Justin. Item number 7 on the agenda is the 2017 CWMU antlerless permit recommendations by Kobe Jones. Will present that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick overview of the antlerless recommendations for this year. So in 2017, 62 CWMUs have CORs that are previously approved. 4 of those are requesting changes, and 12 require RAC and board approval. So the bottom line is right now there are 300 vouchers that are being requested by CWMUs, just a big, broad overlook for antlerless. And 1,216 permits go to the public for draw. So again, a quick overview. A lot of you already know this, but just a reminder that the percentage of private and public antlerless permits is determined by the election of the buck and bull. So a CWMU that's 90-10, 100% of the antlerless permits go to the public, and so on down to where a 75-25 is a 50-50 split. Pronghorn, there is no election. It's always 60-40 for bucks and 40-60 for antlerless or does. If we look at this by region, Double Cone in the northern region first, Double Cone below the objective asked for a request to reduce their permits by 11, and the biologist felt like that was reasonable. So recommend approval there. The rest of these are renewals, and some of these CWMUs are working with us to take a few more antlerless or progressively increase their numbers too. I think I should mention that to help with harvest. Snowville Flats, a new one, Doe Pronghorn, and a new opportunity there, and all of these we recommend approval on. In the southeastern region, two CWMUs there, Mini Mod Ridge and Red Ranches, both previously approved numbers, but in the renewal, asking for 20 and 25, and recommend approval there. All public draw permits for elk. In the southern region, Pavant Ensign was previously two CWMUs. It was the Missouri Flat CWMU on the Pavant and the Black Point CWMU that was just down off. They merged into one. And so you see them both as Pavant Ensign, but the region recommends approval of both of those. So even though it's new, it says new, it is a new CWMU. It functioned previously for years as those other two. In the central region, We're asking for three seat of mews there, asking for changes to the COR. And this was worked out between the biologist and the seat of mew. And the reason why there is because we trapped a lot of elk out of there this winter. We trapped 86 cow elk out of Heber City this winter. And we did that to help augment the population on the Stansberries. We got a population increase on the Stansberries this last year, and we've never had very many elk there. So we decided to give that kind of a jump start and move some elk out there. And the elk that we took from Heber Valley usually summer up on these CWMUs. Cottonwood Ridge is a new CWMU in the northeastern region. Again, 10 permits there, 4 private and 6 public for doe pronghorn. So this is just a breakdown of the summary that we showed at the beginning. Elk, private and public, 236 private vouchers and 1,000 public permits, pronghorn. Deer is 0 and 10, obviously, and pronghorn is 64 private doe permits and 110 public for the total that we showed before. Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. Questions from the public? Questions from the rack? Comments from the public? Comments from the rack? And or motion?
I'll make a motion that we accept the division's proposal as presented.
We have a second. Second from Matt. So the motion on the table is to accept as presented. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Unanimous. Thank you. All right, number 8 is the CWMU antlerless variance requests.
Okay. Before I start this presentation, I guess what I would say is I was contacted by the landowner. He was unaware of this meeting, but he did send out some emails. I know he emailed Byron. Byron received the email, and he asked that it be read here by the RAC chair, if that's okay. Did you also
receive
email?
I don't have that email.
Okay,
but Byron, I would be happy to. If Byron, if you want to read it, okay, that'd be awesome.
I'll give it to you and let you read it.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll present the variants, and then we can.
All right, I'll do that.
Thank you. Okay. So in rule, there's a variance process, and the way the variance works is if you don't meet the minimum criteria of the rule for one reason or another, you can go to the CWMU Advisory Committee. And the Advisory Committee advises the division and the board, but they can make an independent recommendation of the division. And we had one CWMU apply for that this year. The Double R Ranch is owned by Burke Roney. And it's here on the bottom. It's the Strawberry Highlands property. It's about 6,600 acres, and it currently functions as a deer CWMU. To the north, you'll see Fitzgerald Land and Livestock. There's about 5,600 acres there. This is all in the Strawberry Valley. If you're looking, it's to the east of the Strawberry Valley right there. And there's about 5,600 acres of Fitzgerald property. Between the two is the Strawberry River Corridor. And in the Strawberry River Corridor, that ground is now public ground. So there's no way for these two to be contiguous parcels. So you're looking at about a 12,200 acre between the two parcels, but they're non-contiguous. And that's the variance they're requesting. They're requesting a variance to be a non-contiguous elk CWMU. The CWMU Advisory Committee heard the request and had a unanimous vote to accept the variance as presented. The division, we evaluated this, we looked at the rule, and at this time we can't support the CWMU Advisory Committee's recommendation. It doesn't meet the criteria set forth in rule, and we feel like we have to stay true to the rule. It's not that we're not sympathetic, though. We are, and we understand that these large chunks of private land provide a lot of habitat, provide a lot of elk, a lot of surplus animals. So here are the things that we are committed to do, and that is We are currently conducting a landowner rule revision. The landowner limited entry landowner rule works really well on units that don't have a lot of private ground and don't have a lot of private landowners. An example being the Vernon. Works great on the Vernon. You can get guys together, meet the criteria in the rule, which is 51% of the private land signs up, and then they're allocated a portion of the unit tags. It doesn't work very well on a unit like the Wasatch. You can't get that many people to agree on anything. So we'll commit to that, and we'll commit to bringing that before the Wildlife Board by at least this round of RAC meetings next year, by this RAC board. And with that, thank you.
Okay, questions from the public. And I'll read that during the comment section, maybe. Questions from the RAC.
This still wouldn't prohibit them from just allowing access or granting access or selling access, if you will, to, you know, right?
No, there's nothing in state code that prevents a landowner from selling trespass. You know, the difference would be that you're prohibited on who your clients are.
Any comments from the public before we... I'll go ahead and read this email then. This is from Burke Roney. And the email says, I want to thank the division and the RAC for the opportunity to present my variance request tonight. I'm grateful that there's a process to apply for variance and to be heard. That the fact that there is a process means that there might just be, even if only in rare instances, an appropriate circumstance that would merit consideration for a variance. We believe that we are one of these. I'm also thankful for the CWU board that did vote unanimously to recommend us for approval. Likewise, our region, the Central Region RAC Board, also approved us unanimously last night for approval and consideration before the Big Game Board. Hopefully this RAC will feel the same. I also want to say that I understand and respect the fact that Covey and the division has to respect the integrity of the official policies and can't officially recommend this application for approval because it does not, in fact, comply with the continuance 10,000-acre one-size-fits-all policy. Having said that, the RAC boards have the right and option of recommending approval for a variance or application that does not meet the exact criteria of the CWU policies. It will ultimately be up to the Big Game Board to determine whether this variance is granted or not. I would ask this RAC board today to consider the circumstances of the applicants and their property and to approve the request. Property description. I believe that Covey will have described the property and location in consideration. My property is 6,600 acres and the Fitzgerald's just over 5,600 acres. So a combined 12,200 acres, just over 19 square miles of land. We are an elk property. We have an abundant feed, water places of protection and refuge, and most importantly, elk. We have it all as far as quality elk habitat. Honestly, if the state allowed for units to be under 10,000 acres, both the Fitzgerald land and I have places that would easily succeed as independent units. We have the habitat. But this is not the current rule, so we are putting in together to exceed the 10,000 acre minimum requirement. We only lack being continuance by about 1/4 mile. The key justification in asking for the variance is that at one time our properties were continuance. In the 1980s, the BOR CUP, under threat of condemnation, forced both property owners to sell their lands for a corridor along the river for the CUP project and for the Bureau of Reclamation purposes. With great protest, the owners reluctantly sold the land. Documents for the transaction show that this sale was based on a threat of condemnation. This was in fact taking, but both owners, after years of previous experience, cooperated with them, but with no real choice of their own, and therefore sold the land off to the BOR, rather than have eminent domain imposed. Here is a map showing the ownership before the properties were divided. I don't know if the map's up there.
We can attest that it was contiguous.
Okay. There are strong feelings about this even today, some 30 plus years later. We are not here to discuss that today so much as to point out that the owners of this land were cooperative with the state and other entities and now are asking that they cooperate with us and allow us to be treated as one CWMU, even though technically there is a very small stretch of land that does not allow us to be contiguous. Again, we would be contiguous if the land had not been strong-armed by the BOR, CUP, and other agencies to sell with threat of condemnation. The small space of land between us would not be included as part of the CWMU. This would remain as it currently is, open to the public access, including to the current adjacent private property owners. We have proposed a scenario where perhaps an additional tag could be given to the public to compensate for the lack of contiguous land. Instead of 9-1, the split could be 10-2 or a greater share of antlers tag going to the public or something along those lines. We are open to the suggestions of the Big Game Board on this. Here are some more reasons why this is beneficial to the public. More hunting opportunities on private ground not currently accessible. Levels the playing field. Elk take refuge on us. Public hunter not satisfied with the number of elk they are seeing, and yet some of the private landowners can attest that there are elk on them and plenty of them. There will be pressure on our private found on elk to move on to public lands. Increases hunting opportunities and hunter success rates on the public ground around the property. We have no other option. There is no other private ground contiguous to us or even near us. We are surrounded nearly all sides by Forest Service lands. The current one-size-fits-all of the unit being 10,000 acres or more is hard on a lot of excellent elk habitat areas that just don't have the acreage but certainly have the habitat. Frankly, we are one of those. However, given the current policy on that, we are doing all we can to make this easier for the Big Game Board and for you to recommend approval. I guess we're doing all we can do and then coming to you to ask if you can help us with the rest. We are currently a deer CWMU unit on our side, and we have been successful with very good rating, and this will not affect us negatively. But in fact, we have a proven track record already knowing how to manage her unit. I currently run cattle on our ranch, and Larry Fitzgerald also, of course, is an ag and cattleman and serves on the Central Region RAC board. I think as a side note, this will be very helpful exercise to show the relationship and harmony that can exist for both agricultural and managed wildlife purposes. I've been doing this for years. Without the financial benefit of the private hunting unit, many of the ag guys have no motivation to participate in creating more opportunities for the public. I think this will be a wonderful thing. I thank you for your time and ask you to please vote to recommend approval to the Big Game Board. Burke Rooney. Okay, any other comment and or discussion on the action item? Justin, and then Craig.
Yeah, I have a question. You said that this
Craig
cat...
and then Justin. Oh. Go ahead, Craig.
You're fine, you started, you're good.
Go ahead, Craig.
So basically you're saying you can't do it because of rule? Because of the rule?
No, I'm saying that we can't recommend it or support it because of rule.
Okay.
My comment would be I'm sympathetic to the position they're in as far as it took place 30 years ago, that they feel they were strong-armed into selling part of their property, but I would not only say no, I'd almost say hell no. I just think it causes we're going down a slippery slope and we start allowing people that ground does not touch to start to do this. I take issue even with multiple landowners, that's my own personal opinion, going in and being able to form a CWMU, but I like that you're sticking to your rules, and I believe you need to continue to do that.
Any other comments?
I have a question.
Russ?
Are any of those collared elk in those units or in those in that private property?
I'm sure there are. I mean, this is the area where we've collared a lot of elk. I know that these properties hold a lot of elk.
Bryce? This is kind of what that private land cow elk tag. I mean, there are probably two particular ranches that it was targeting when they came up with this rule. So I kind of have the same, you know, stick with the rule unless you guys come up with a, you know, variance by neck or a new rule by next year. But I'd almost say stick with the rule too.
Matt?
How often have variances like this happened in the past?
Um, That's a good question. There are always variances. There are always, you know, we presented a variance last year for Missouri Flat, CWMU, when they reapplied for Black Point. However, the situation was a little different where they'd been operating as a CWMU with non-contiguous property for, since the program initiated. So it was almost a grandfather issue. And the rule hasn't always been the same. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. You know, we have CWMUs that look very differently today because they've been in the program since the initiation, then, and they wouldn't even qualify now. So the rule has been modified over time to create a better hunting experience for the public, and make things that work. So that question's really hard to answer because it's saying the variances weren't always the same consistently for throughout the whole program. There are occasions when we have recommended approval, as we did last year, or occasions when they have been approved.
When a variance is approved, for how long? Is that like for a year? Can you put a time limit on it? Or
we wouldn't view it that way. We would view it as they have a variance to apply as a CWMU, so in the fall they would be clear to submit an application. And then just like all the other CWMUs, we would review the application and, you know, make sure it fit, allocate the right number of permits, and move forward. We wouldn't view it as the variance was only good for three-year COR period. It would be a variance for the CWMU in perpetuity.
Any other comments? Kevin?
You know, I agree with the concept. It's a, but where do you set the limit? That's my concern. Is where do you? This is a quarter of a mile separation. Is the next one that's requested a half a mile separation? And so if there is going to be a rule change, I think it's got to be well thought out. And then is this the slippery slope that? Do we continue to make those rule changes? I don't know. It's a hard decision.
Okay, thanks. Any other comments, Matt?
I guess the only heartburn really that I'm having about this is just the fact that the state took the land in the first place. I mean, the state claimed eminent domain or threatened eminent domain to take the land, and now is telling them they can't do this because the state owns the land in between where the state took the land.
And maybe it's not a big distinction, but just make sure that we're knowing that this was a part of the CUP project. So this was the Bureau of Reclamation. This was the feds that came in. And it's accurate. I mean, there were some parcels in Duchesne County where the landowner said, we're not going to sell. And they did condemn the land. They just said, okay, you don't have to. We got it. So these were willing sellers, but they did feel like they were under duress, for whatever that's worth.
My opinion, I'd feel more sympathetic if it was the same owner and they come in and split his property. It's two different owners, right or wrong. I think that's something to consider.
John?
My understanding is this took place 30 years ago.
That's correct.
It's not like they just barely did that. It's 30 years ago. And I'm sure that they've been selling hunting permits on their property, right? If they want income or if they want to manage the animals. They're not limited to do that. I know there are a lot of landowners with less than acreage who would literally like to have a variance too. But boy, we got a lot of CWMUs in northern Utah right now. I think that we need to stay by rule.
Thanks. Bryce?
I'd like to make a motion that we deny or support the division and deny the variance.
We have a second. Second from Kevin. Discussion. Motion to deny the variance request. No discussion. We'll call the question. All those in favor of the motion to deny the variance request, indicate by saying aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? None. Okay, so motion carries, unanimous. Okie doke, that's the end of the action items for tonight.
Thank you.
I do have a comment card from Mr. Ward regarding turkey boundaries. And I don't know if you're still here, Mr. Ward, or not, but if you are, we will consider that agenda item will be brought up at the May 3rd RAC meeting. And so if you want to come back and talk about your interest in changing those turkey boundaries, that would be the opportunity. If not, you can email the RAC board and we can have that information for consideration on the agenda item. I think that's all of the business for tonight. Seeing if there are no other questions or items, we will, without objection, adjourn. Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you all, and we'll see you next month.